This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about a boogie woogie, and I'm going to play one.
I'm Steve Vincent.
I'm Paul Schultz.
And this is the Don't Panic Radio Show. Sit back, relax, and ignore the news. Nothing you're about to hear is true.
Now here's something we hope you'll really like.
Welcome to the Don't Panic Radio Show. I'm Steve Vincent.
And I'm Paul Schultz.
And we have the privilege of sitting here next to Tony Isabella. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
Thanks for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Super cool.
We're in beautiful downtown Elkhart, Indiana.
Elkhart is a lovely city.
It's nice. I haven't been downtown, I don't think. I grew up about an hour from here.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever been downtown. I do know they make RVs and musical instruments.
Yeah, that's true.
And apparently put on pretty good comic book conventions.
For at least 2 years.
For a couple of years.
Yeah.
So, Tony, thanks for being on the show. Now, I know that all of our listeners actually know that you created Black Lightning. When the TV show is on, we review every episode.
Yeah, week by week by week.
And every single week, Paul brings you up, which is fantastic.
I'm not a name dropper at all.
But We'll get to that. We'll get to Black Lightning in a little bit. But first, before we get there, we've talked about you to our listeners. They may not know who you are, how you got into comics, why you love comics so much. I'm assuming you love comics.
I do.
I mean, I hate my job, but apparently you love yours. So what got you into comics in the first place?
I learned how to read from comic books when I was 4 years old. Family members used to read comic books to me, and I wanted to cut out the middleman. So I would study the panels and the words as they were reading them to me, and taught myself how to read and taught myself how to write. So by the age of 4, I could read and write. I always loved comics. I thought they were a great way to tell a story, and that's never changed.
I think I've heard that a lot, people talking about learning to read.
That's how I learned, and that's how I taught my son.
Nice.
So it seems to be a common theme, yeah.
There were some books when I was a kid that I used to look at that I think had words in them, but I didn't really learn to read from those books.
Those are the ones your dad hid?
I just kind of looked at the pictures. So 4 years old, you learned to read through comic books. What's the first one you remember reading?
Originally, we used to live in an apartment building next to a funeral home, but on the other side of the funeral home was what I thought as a kid was a newsstand. It was actually a bookie joint, which in later years I realized, oh yeah, they had all those racing forms. But they also had comics and magazines. That was their cover. Like they needed one because everybody knew what they were doing. And so I would go there and buy comics. And I knew Superman from the TV show, and I knew Casper from TV. So it was probably Superman and Casper were among the first comic books I bought.
Nice. You know, I think I remember, actually, you kind of triggered a memory that I'll probably have to explore with my therapist, but I think I might have read a Casper comic book when I was a kid.
This is news to me.
But it's not a thing I think of when I think of comics. I think of the cartoon, you know, because definitely watched the cartoon and this little white ghost floating around all over the place. But
when you consider we grew up out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
It was hard to get to the stores that sold comics on any kind of regular basis. So ours was mostly television.
Right. Love those cartoons. So Casper and Superman. So fast forward, at what point did you realize, hey, I not only can read these, I can write them?
I was a very avid reader all through grade school and everything. I was 12 years old. It was July 1963, a summer much like any other.
See, for a minute I thought he was being real.
Young Tony Isabella is on a boring family trip to Oneonta, New York, a fly speck of a city in upstate New York known mostly for being near the Cooperstown Hall of Fame, which was one of our destinations. We had family in Oneonta. Well, at every stop along the way, I bought a comic book because this was a really boring trip. And comic books were at every stop of the along the way. And when we got to Oneonta, New York, and my granduncle Peter had a cigar and magazine store, and I immediately went for the cigars. No, I didn't. I immediately headed for the comic book rack, at which point my mother grabbed me and said, you know, you can't keep spending your souvenir money on comic books, and which made no logical sense to me.
Right?
Because it was my souvenir money. Anyway, she said I could buy one more comic book. Well, I was going to show her, because like every kid, I knew I was smarter than my parents. I was going to buy a quarter comic. And the only quarter comic that I didn't already have was Fantastic Four Annual Number 1. Now, I didn't even like the Fantastic Four. I'd read one issue and didn't like it. But I was a defiant little cuss, so I bought that comic book, and it turned out to be the greatest comic book ever made.
Wow.
37 pages of Submariner attacking the human race, a reprint of the origin of the Fantastic Four, a new take on Spider-Man meeting the Fantastic Four, pages upon pages of pinups and fact pages.
Yeah.
And somewhere in reading that, I realized making comic books is a job. I want that job.
Yeah, somebody had to put it there.
And so from the age of 12, I started training myself to write comic books. I would take my Marx Army Men, you know, those hard green little plastic army soldiers, and I'd act out superhero stories with them, always feeling very embarrassed for the GI that had to stand in for Wonder Woman. And then, you know, eventually I started trying to write and draw my own comic books and realized I was a much better writer than an artist. But again, being a clever guy, I found schoolmates who could draw. And so they ended up drawing my comics. We would, every 2 months, my buddies and I would put together a comic book called Marvel Madhouse with our own original characters that we would send to Marvel every other month. And we get nice letters back from them. And so, you know, I kept training myself along the way. When I started going to conventions, I met people in the industry. They gave me copies of their script. And that's, you know, I really trained myself how to write comic books. I tried various formats. I got a copy of Stan Lee's Secrets by the Comics, which came out in like 1947 or something. And the script method they described there and showed was a two-column format with the descriptions on one side of the page and the dialogue and captions on the other. So my first typed comic strips were in that format, but it wasn't a format I was comfortable with. So I basically, when I went to Marvel in 72, I worked Marvel style where you do a plot, and then the artist draws it, and then you add the dialogue.
Yeah.
But before long, I was pretty much exclusively writing what they call full scripts. It gives me as a writer more control of the story. I don't feel like I'm writing the same story twice. But again, in this computer age, if an artist has an idea that I like, it's the easiest thing in the world to change the script.
So was this, by this time, were you being paid to write the scripts?
By 1972, after working for amateur magazines and doing amateur strips there, I was hired to work in the Marvel bullpen. I was assisting Stan Lee in putting together what they called British weeklies. These were weekly comic magazines on newsprint, reprinting old Marvel stories. Yeah. We would put them together in America, and they would publish them in the United Kingdom. The staff jobs paid lousy, but they gave you lots of freelance. So I got a chance to write some comic stories. They liked my comics writing. So eventually I ended up doing more comics writing than editorial work.
Freelance, way better than exposure as payment.
Because you can work in your pajamas, which they frown on in most offices.
Right.
Except for pajama day.
You know, as an aside, I just learned the other day where the word freelance came from.
Where does it come from?
Freelancer. Mm-hmm. Like these guys with the lances back in the medieval days, and they weren't loyal to any one king. They would fight for whoever paid them.
They were the mercenaries of their day.
Exactly. Freelancers. How about that?
I think I got an idea for a book.
So how do you go about in those days? Was Stan Lee the obviously not the icon, but was he well known in comic circles in those
in
days?
In comic circles, Stan was definitely well known. So
how do you get a job? You said, I got hired. Did you answer an ad in the paper?
My fallback job was to work for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, wretched newspaper that was the tool of the rich and the powerful.
Okay.
Because I kind of thought if I couldn't write comic books, I would be Clark Kent.
One way or the other, he
that
was going to be in
That didn't work
comics.
Out because, again, it was the kind of paper where the mayor could call up and get a story killed.
Mm-hmm.
We went on strike.
Oh, wow.
The publisher called the mayor and asked him if he could do something about these people in front of their building picketing. And we were attacked by mounted policemen.
Oh, my gosh.
I was knocked to the ground by a fearful copy editor. A horse's hoof landed inches away from my feet. I dusted myself off. I went home. I called Roy Thomas, who I knew from corresponding with him and from conventions, and asked Roy if there was even an entry-level job at Marvel. It was right time, right place.
Yeah.
They needed somebody who really knew Marvel history, and at that point, there was only 10 years of Marvel history,
so
it was pretty easy. So that I got the job of assisting Stan on these British books.
Mm-hmm.
And, I would design covers. I'd write cover copy. I'd break up the stories into chapters.
Mm-hmm.
I'd write new splash pages. I'd write letters pages.
That probably helped the writing process a lot, too, learning how to break them down and
oh,
stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like you learn
but I always
everything
studied
you learn
comics.
From. Yeah.
Once I decided, I'd be a writer, I studied the comic books I bought.
Mm-hmm.
I picked up tricks from like Bob Canninger, who did Sergeant Rock and Metal Men.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot from Stan, obviously, from Roy Thomas, from Len Wein, who is one of the best solid wordsmiths.
Yeah.
I mean, with a lyrical style of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I studied all these guys and I picked up stuff from them. And I threw in other influences like Neil Simon for the more comedy stuff, Dave Barry. O. Henry, who I loved his little shock ending stories. Shakespeare, because I liked the rhythm of the language he used.
Mm-hmm.
And all that went into the mix.
I've never seen, other than your writing, I've never seen a comic with iambic pentameter, except for that one issue.
The funny thing is that I didn't really realize I was doing that until Jack C. Harris, who was my editor on the first Black Lightning series, says, "It's a good thing your stuff is so good that I don't have to change it, because I don't know how I would rewrite your stuff in iambic pentameter." And that was like the first realization I had that I was doing that. I don't think I do that anymore, but it's possible. I don't think about my influences when I'm writing.
Right. Oh, that's good. That's good. So you're working at Marvel and...
I'm working at Marvel. I started in late 72. I worked on staff. I was editing black and white magazines. Marvel went through a lot of changes. Roy Thomas stepped down. He was always my favorite editor there. Len Wein was editor for a little bit. Marv Wolfman was editor for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry Conway was editor for like 3 weeks. It was just too chaotic.
Yeah.
And so when an offer came in to go to work for DC,
mm-hmm.
I agreed to it.
What kind of job was that?
Well, again, that goes into my sordid history with DC Comics, which up until recently, and new management came in, mm-hmm. had never honored any of its agreements with me.
Oh, yeah.
So I was lured over to DC being told that I would write Batman and Justice League of America and new books, that I would be editing and things like that. The reality was that the Batman and Justice League assignments never materialized. I came on staff as an editor, which I'd been at Marvel. I'd been a full editor at Marvel. I chose the artist. I wrote the cover copies. I designed the cover. At DC, I was considered a story editor.
Ah.
And I was told I could not talk to the artists.
And I'm you don't get, want to talk to artists.
I was going to say,
they're,
to be
they're,
honest,
they're
sure
surly lot.
Dick Ayers was drawing, you know, one of my books. Dick Ayers and I had been friends since I got into the business.
I met him once. I knew how to
work with Dick.
Yeah.
Because Stanley had taught me how to get Dick really excited, which at that point in his career, you needed to excite Dick.
Yeah, of course.
That's what you were going for.
I've heard
for,
that about this
you?
Industry.
That's what
more
you
than
were
once.
Going
you're
for.
You're going to get an education today.
Apparently. That's true in my industry, too. I'm a project manager in pharmaceuticals. I got to excite Dick every day.
But yeah, it's you know, and so after about 3-4 months on staff, I couldn't take it anymore, and I quit. Mm-hmm. I moved back to Ohio for good.
You know, I met Dick Ayers twice. And one of the times when I met him, my ex-wife at the time was pregnant, and she was fixing a pop. And he was super cool. He's like, "Why don't you come behind the table?" Because he was doing some stuff, and we were talking about Ghost Rider and stuff. And he let her sit at the table, and we talked for a while. Offered her a sandwich.
Was that Atticus she was pregnant with?
Yes, actually, it was.
So this is not his first convention.
Technically, no. This is his first on this side.
On this side of the womb.
Yes.
Yeah, got it. Okay.
Yes.
But Dick and Lindy Ayers are just terrific people. One of the few downsides of my getting into the industry when I did, I got to work with so many writers and artists whose work I had grown up with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The downside of that is they die.
Yeah.
And now even writers and artists of my generation, like Len Wein and Bernie Wrightson and Rich Buckler, are passing.
Yeah.
And that's really tough. I mean, this past week, where we lost in quick succession, Russ Heath,
yep.
Marie Severin, and Gary Friedrich on the same day.
Yeah, on the
and
same
day. And then the next day, Neil Simon passed away. So I was not a happy guy that week.
Yeah. No, not at all.
But I felt really good that I didn't know Russ well, but I worked with Mary and Gary, and I knew them well. And so I had that.
Her Hulk is actually my favorite rendition of Hulk.
Marie can do could do anything.
Yes.
Were you able to stay in touch with them over the years?
Gary, to a certain extent, until his Parkinson's got bad. Mm. Marie, it was mostly secondhand because my friends Scott Edelman and Irene Vartanoff would visit her, and they convey messages to her and vice versa. But yeah, I was not really close with Marie, but anybody who worked at Marvel loved her. She was.
That seems to be what I've heard about her.
You know, and she wasn't a patsy.
Mm-hmm.
If you got her mad, she could get back at you in the most creative way. Usually with her pencil and pen.
Oh.
Well, until recently, I mean, being a woman in a mostly, I imagine, male-dominated industry, she held her own. It sounds
You know, when I got into Marvel, outside of Marie and the secretaries, everybody who worked in comics was pretty much somebody's girlfriend or wife.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, but now, I mean, now we have such, you know, incredible diversity in the field, which I adore.
That's great. I would not have guessed that.
Oh, yeah, no, we have, you know, gay or straight, men and women.
Comics have always been a reflection.
People of faith and atheists. I mean, you know, conservatives and smart people.
Trump supporters? How many Trump supporters are in the comic
industry?
Oh,
too many.
Would Captain America be a Trump supporter?
No. Right. Captain America was an FDR liberal.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Got it.
Comic books have always been more progressive than anything else. I mean, because they were outlaws, the superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
They were not authority figures until, you know, basically after the Comics Code.
Yeah.
Or during the war, they were accepted more within their stories.
Yeah.
One of the best anti-war novels of all time. In fact, one of the best 100 novels of all time. The Watchmen.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, it may look pro-war when you watch the comedian running around, you know, lighting people up, or Dr. Manhattan killing Vietnamese, but definite anti-war message in that one.
And that was, you know, while there were plenty of gung-ho war comics in the 50s and 60s, but you look at Harvey Kurtzman's war comics for EC, and Archie Goodwin's Blazing Combat. Those are not, you know, pro-war comics.
No.
Charlton had this brilliant series called The Lonely War of Captain Willie Schultz, which was a German-American soldier falsely accused of a crime who ended up, just for surviving, blending in with the Germans and, and fighting alongside the Germans until it got to the point where he had to just get away from that.
I've never heard of that one. I thought it was
written by Willie Franz, who was in his teens when he wrote it, and drawn by the great Sam Glasman. And I believe there is, if it's not already out, I believe there is a complete collection
That
works.
That sounds really interesting.
Man, the show notes are going to take a lot of work this time. There's a lot. So since we're on the topic of diversity, I was joking with Paul on the way over here. I didn't actually think this, but I said it would be funny if I met you and said, oh, my God, I thought you'd be black.
Oh, I have a story there.
So how is it that I don't want to say you're super white, but, like, I wouldn't say that. That would be kind of racist.
I'm Italian, so I'm only part white.
Yeah, part white. From Sicily or the mainland?
Three-fourths Italian, one-fourth Sicilian.
Okay.
Which you wouldn't think would be a big thing, but it is among Italian families.
Hey, I've seen, what's the movie we were talking about the other day?
The guy. Oh, True Romance.
True Romance. Yeah, they talk about Sicilians. There's the whole speech.
Yeah.
But, okay.
Well, before I give you the secret the origin of this, I should say that there's a book that came out a couple of decades ago, and in its first edition, it's a book called Comic Book Nation, and it was about current topics in comics. And in that book, I am identified as one of the few African-American writers
comics. I think that's at my library. I'm going to have to go look for it.
It's
familiar.
It's only the first edition.
Okay. Oh, they changed it?
They told him. I wish I could have seen his face when they told him. But basically, here's what happened. I grew up in Cleveland, a very segregated city. My first black friends were comic book fans who came from the east side of Cleveland to the west side of Cleveland, where I ran a comic book club out of the Cadell Recreation Center. And so my first black friends were comic book fans. Now, the Cadell Recreation was in the news a few years back because that was where a young man named Tamir Rice was gunned down by incompetent police officers who should not have even been on the force. And that, to me, that's, you know, the place that brought me such joy is also now a scene of horror.
Yeah.
And it does figure into Black Lightning, Cold Dead Hands, my 2017-2018 reboot of the character, which is set in Cleveland.
Yeah.
And that kind of police violence and no accountability for police violence factors into the series.
I love the fact that you just didn't pull any punches or mince words in that series. Whatever was in your head came out on the page.
Yeah.
I love that series. I love it.
Well, as we were talking earlier, I didn't grow up with comic books, not a big comic book guy, but this Watchmen said, hey, maybe there's something to this superhero stuff. About that time, the TV series Black Lightning came out, and so I was like, oh, let me check this out, see what this is like. Then Paul said, hey, I know the guy that created that.
Oh, I tell you, and the TV series is such a joy to me.
Yeah.
A few years back, new management came into DC and DC Comics, and they wanted to basically try to make things right between me and them. Because prior to that, it had been decades of DC not honoring its agreements with me, cheating me on the financial end. The new management came in and, you know, they reached out to me. We worked out an agreement that covers my past work and my present work. And the first thing DC asked me to do for them was to write a core values paper on Black Lightning.
Oh, wow.
And that core values paper is the start of the TV series. And it also, you know, it's the same core values in my comics and in the TV series. Then when they hired the brilliant Salim and Marb Rock Akil to be the showrunners, and I am the creator of Black Lightning. They are the creators of the Black Lightning TV series. Two very different things.
Right.
But we had phone conferences. They asked, you know, all sorts of questions. It was clear early on that we were both committed to the same type of stories.
Yeah.
To getting these characters right. Before the first season started shooting, they flew me out to Burbank to spend a day with the writers, and was that a trip?
Oh, yeah.
I walk into the writers' room, and on one side of the wall, there's this big board with the 13 episodes very roughly broken down.
Wow.
And just glancing at it, there's a lot of me in there.
On
the other side of the room are pictures of comic book characters and names. Half of them are mine.
Yeah.
And then for 6 hours, the writers grilled me on every detail. I mean, they studied these
it shows,
books.
Though.
Yes.
Their grilling shows in season one.
Did you write Tobias? Is that your character?
I created Tobias Whale. The TV show does it better than I ever did.
Oh, really?
In fact, when I rebooted Black Lightning, Tobias Whale was no longer an albino because I felt bad that every albino in comics was a villain.
Yeah,
Croydon, who plays Tobias Whale so brilliantly, said, Tony, why did you make Tobias not a,
He's like, why'd you get rid of my job?
And I said, no, if I had known that the TV Tobias Whale would be done as well as you do him, I wouldn't have done that. But I have promised Croydon that I will do an albino superhero.
Nice.
And he is among the projects that I have on my desk at the moment.
Oh, that's
but yeah, fantastic. So I love the show. I would exchange messages with cast members.
Hmm.
And when, I went to the premiere in Washington, D.C., and met the entire cast, who were just wonderful, wonderful people.
Yeah.
Cress Williams was going around this event looking for me.
Oh, wow.
Is Tony Isabella here? I want to meet Tony Isabella. I brought my, I walked the red carpet at the premiere, and a couple of the news outlets, who kind of knew who I was, did interview me. My adult son, who I'd brought, was very impressed by this.
Yeah.
Especially during the after party when actual celebrities are wanting to take selfies with me.
Oh, wow.
And
they're not charging you like they do at the comic convention.
I'm playing like this is just every day.
Yeah, this happens
and it's
every
not.
Day.
I'm just being cool. One of the biggest Black Lightning fans is the comedian Sinbad.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's out.
Sinbad played him in the Death of Superman sketch on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, it's hysterical.
Funniest Saturday Night.
He's from here, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Sinbad and I have talked on the phone over the years.
Yeah.
And he was in he was at the Cleveland Roxino last winter doing a show. And he calls me up and says, Tony, we've never met. You have to come to my show. I said, Sinbad, your show sold out. And he goes, not for you, it's not. So I go to the show, and I go to the will call, and I said, I'm here. My name's Tony Isabella. I'm picking up my tickets. And they go, these are Sinbad's tickets.
Oh.
And they're grilling me. How do you know Sinbad? I said, because I created a comic book character he liked. And they're really looking suspicious at me until a more superior person comes over and says, Sinbad wants him at the show. Sinbad had wanted me to come backstage right after the show.
Uh-huh.
But again, middle management, they screwed that up.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm in a line with people who have paid extra to meet him.
Oh, yeah.
So we're ushered into this green room area. Sinbad comes in the room, goes by everybody in the room, gives me a big hug. And we sit there talking about comics for 20 minutes all these people who have paid extra to have a moment with Sinbad are wondering, who is this guy?
Because you paid a lifetime of extra.
That's right.
He has his opening act. He hands his cell phone to his opening act and says, take a picture of me with Tony.
Oh, wow.
And then he puts it on Instagram saying, this is Tony Isabella. He created Black Lightning. He's a great man. He's one of the most woke people in the world.
Woke, yeah.
And I like to think that I'm so woke that I have insomnia.
Nice.
But when Sinbad tells you that you're
Sinbad
that woke,
you
and again, that was that impressed a lot of people.
Yeah. Steve, if you haven't seen it, I'm sure YouTube has it.
Oh, yeah. It
Sinbad is Black Lightning.
I'll call him up and ask him.
Brilliant, brilliant sketch.
Yeah.
His son is a filmmaker who had wanted to do Black Lightning.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
But here's a Mara Brock Akil, before she was, when she was just Mara Brock, worked, she was a receptionist on the Sinbad show.
Hmm.
So he wants to be on the show.
Nice.
Coincidentally enough, I would love to write an episode of the show. Even more coincidentally, coincidentally, I have a one-off story that he would be perfect for the lead character of.
Nice. Well, maybe he'll hear this episode. I mean, Sinbad's a fan, right?
Yeah.
He's from Michigan City.
Yeah.
Which is where I grew up.
Yeah, roughly, so. Yeah.
Yeah, there's, I tell you, I really like, Sinbad, from the moment I get, this is a real guy.
Yeah.
He's Midwest.
Yeah.
You know, the real part of America.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The part that people in New York and L.A. think you just fly over.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've gotten to meet, my second love being cheesy monster movies.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten to meet all the owners of the Asylum that make movies like Sharknado.
Oh, yeah.
And we bonded. And again, those are Midwest guys.
Yeah. People give those movies so much crap. But they're just movies to watch to have fun to. They're not Shakespeare.
The Asylum was impressed that I knew Sharknado was going to be a hit before they did. And people were laughing at me. They said, what, are you crazy? I said, no, this is going to be big. Sharknado is going to be huge. And they go, what do you mean? I said, look, sharks, tornadoes, Sharknado, it will be huge. And they're all laughing at me until that night it airs and celebrities are tweeting about it. And the next day, sports talk, sports radio is talking about Sharknado.
Wow.
So I am like the idiot savant of cheesy monster movies.
Well, you got to pick the next one. I mean, it's one thing to tell us a story about how you picked Sharknado, but you got to tell us what the next one's going to be.
We need a don't panic exclusive. I should tell you this.
There is a possibility, because the Asylum has extended an offer to me that I haven't been able to take up on yet to join their writers' pool.
Oh, wow.
Now, I won't go into what all their business model is,
right. Mm-hmm.
But one of the things they asked me to do was submit like 7 movies as if I were pitching them to them. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not their business model. If it were their business model, they told me they would have bought all 7. But the one that convinced them that I was ready for them was one called Mega Shark versus Alien Iceberg.
Oh, wow.
And it has a story. It's even a coherent story. And I love it so much that I'm going to be talking to them about licensing Mega Shark so I can do this as a graphic novel.
Oh, Mega Shark versus Alien. Write that down. We got to invest.
I happen to know a pretty good artist if you need any.
It depends whether you can bring the Mega to the Shark.
I'll do my best.
Right. Can you get Dick excited?
Mega excited.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, it's I love that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about being woke, so the TV show, obviously, I'm watching it and I'm going, wow, it's very topical. It's very clearly takes on the issues of the day very on the nose.
There's a real commitment. Everyone who works on the show, the actors, the writers, they want to tell these real stories. And obviously, they're real stories in a superhero setting,
mm-hmm.
but they're committed to those stories. They're committed to making it as real as possible, and they're committed to the core values of these characters I created.
So the core values, so when you created the characters, what decade time frame was that?
That was in 1970s.
So plenty of issues back then as well.
Yeah, there were. And
a few.
DC Comics had wanted me to take over a book that they had bought 2 scripts for called The Black Bomber. Mm-hmm. And to give you the short version, The Black Bomber was a white racist.
Nice.
Who turned into a black superhero.
Oh, wow.
And that was just the top of the offensiveness iceberg of
like
this
Chappelle
character.
Before Chappelle.
Oh, it was so awful. And I read the 2 scripts. They wanted me to punch them up and then take over the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I refused to do it.
Yeah.
I said, these are the most offensive comics I've ever read. If you publish these comics, people will come to your offices with torches and pitchforks. And they go, how could you know that? I said, I will be the one leading them.
Yeah. I got the pitchforks.
So finally, I boiled it down to, do you really want your first major black superhero to be a white racist?
Yeah.
And they kind of go, oh, yeah. So I had like 3 weeks to create Black Lightning.
Oh, wow.
So I wanted to do a very positive characters. I had written black characters at Marvel, but I wanted to bump it up a step.
Mm-hmm.
So every kid has a teacher.
Yeah.
They know what teacher's on, so that struck me as a good civilian job for him.
As opposed to a millionaire, playboy, industrialist.
It was, again, more real, more relatable.
Yeah.
The fact that the one time he tries to fight the gangs, as a teacher, one of his kids gets killed and hung up on a basketball, basketball net. And I still can't believe that in 1977, I was able to get that into a comic book.
Yeah,
it's very like.
It didn't make it. It was in one of the original scripts for the TV show and didn't make it into the actual show.
Even now, yeah, I hear you.
But that was it. I wanted to tell more down to earth stories with a very positive black character. Didn't mean he was without flaws. And, you know, even though the that was a tricky time for comic book sales, it lasted, I think, 9 issues, maybe more than that, but 9 or 10 issues.
Yeah, it wasn't.
But, you know, it was, the character was popular enough that they kept him around. And I wrote him again in the 90s. And that, I thought, was my best work ever with an artist named Eddie Newell.
Yeah.
And then they got a new editor on the book who fired me before the first issue. I'd written 9 issues of the book, and he fired me before 6 weeks before the first issue came out, saying that I was late with the scripts.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. That makes total sense.
Yeah. Yeah, well, again, comics never make sense.
Yeah.
It hasn't in the 46 years I've been in the business. I don't expect it to start.
It's not going to start now, right?
Yeah, but then again, and then... Like, every 20 years, like Locust, I do a new Black Lightning series. And I did this Black Lightning Cold Dead Hands, which is a reboot of the character. He's younger. He's smarter. He's not married yet, but I love his daughters. So he's got two cousins that are essentially the same characters.
Yeah, because it kind of, reading it, I'm like, oh, this is a reboot, Paul. This is a reboot.
Yes, yes. And I didn't, well, because I didn't redo the origin.
Yeah.
If I do more with this version of the character, I will show you his origin, which obviously doesn't involve Tobias Whale, because he's just met Tobias Whale.
Yeah, yeah.
And I set the whole thing in Cleveland, which was great fun for me.
Nice, yeah, absolutely.
Kind of, you know, and not to brag, but I'm one of Cleveland Magazine's most interesting people of 2018.
Nice.
And I love... I set the series in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
If action takes place at a real place, I changed the name of the real place.
Okay. Right, right.
Okay.
But, yeah, you will recognize the climactic battle takes place at the abandoned Coast Guard station on Whiskey Island. And I think in the comic book, it's the abandoned Coast Guard station on Scotch Island.
yeah.
But it's the same building.
Yeah.
In fact, I'd never been there. I'd sent the artist photo reference. When the local CW station wanted to interview me for a bit that'll run when the second season of the TV series premieres, they said, let's go to a comic shop. And I said, yes, we could go to a comic shop to interview me. It's been done 1,000 times before.
Yeah.
Let's do this instead.
Yeah,
I like it.
So we went out to the abandoned Coast Guard station, which is now owned by Cleveland Metro Parks. They gave us permission to film there. I'd never been there before. But standing in front of the place, the artist had nailed it in the comic book. I felt like I was in my own comic book story.
Nice. Worlds were colliding.
Yeah.
So when do you? So speaking of such things like that, when do you? Do you get your cameo? Your walk on?
We have talked about that. The various cast members say they really want to do a cameo with me. I'm hoping to get to Atlanta, which is where they film the series. I'm hoping to get there while they're filming the second season, so that I can do my cameo.
That'd be great.
And what do you want? What do you want your character to be?
I want all the women on the show to fall in love with me.
I think that's plausible.
And Black Lightning just have to deal with the fact that he's no longer the most desirable man on the show. No, we've done. I mean,
all the straight women.
They asked me to the gay ones too, because
that's cool.
They can be flexible.
That's right.
But no, I mean, they actually asked me when I was in the writer's room. They wanted me to do a test for the Peter Gamby character.
Oh, wow.
And I wish I had done it. It would have sucked. There's no doubt in my mind I would be the worst Peter Gamby in the history of Peter Gambys. But I wish I had done it just so that I would have had that awful clip.
Yeah.
And now I'm told that James Remar, the brilliant actor who plays him on the TV show, who was Dexter's dad, adopted dad in Dexter. He's telling people that he only got the job because he looks like me. James is being way too kind to me and way too hard on himself.
Nice.
But that's, I mean...
Well, because you didn't test for it. If you had tested for it, there's no way you would have gotten it.
I wouldn't have gotten it. Really, I know my limitations. I can do a convention panel. I recently did a presentation.
There you go.
From Black Lightning Cold Dead Hands number 1 at a Cleveland nightclub. It was an event called the Tap Dance Killers Comic Book Cabaret.
Wow.
And it went really well, so that's something I'm adding to my repertoire. But I can do panels. I give talks on comics and comics history and diversity in comics at schools and libraries. But acting, that takes talent. Also, doing stand-up takes talent, which I also found I don't have. I can write jokes, but I can't perform them very well. Although, I mean, when I'm doing a panel, you know, I can make with the funny.
It's a whole different thing.
Right. It's a whole different thing. My life doesn't depend on whether the joke lands or not. I go to a convention every year called the East Coast Black Age of Comics Convention.
I've been trying to get out there.
It's a nonprofit organization. It's a smaller convention. It's black oriented. I'm usually their only white guest. Their poster looks like the Black Brady Bunch and Alice. And they always have me. They have these awards, the Glyph Awards, and they always ask me to present one of them. Not this year, but the previous year, I'm presenting an award, and I'd written this joke for it, and I wasn't sure it would land. And so I announced, and the winner, I think it was maybe best artist or something, and the winner is La La Land. Brought the house down.
Yeah, of course that crowd would get it, right?
Yes, it landed.
Shoo.
Got to know your audience, right?
That's right.
But again, if I had to get up on stage and do 20 minutes of jokes, I would bomb so badly.
Only the first 100 or 200 times.
Yeah.
So I'm 67 years old. Do you really think I have 100 chances at stand-up comedy?
Hey, moisturize, take care of yourself.
All right. Get a little walking in.
What have we not asked you? You get interviewed all the time. So you're a better interviewee.
You haven't asked
than
me about my religious affiliation.
Tell me about your religious affiliation.
I am the pastor of the First Church of Godzilla.
It's a thing.
On Facebook.
Yeah.
Because after comics, my second love is cheesy monster movies.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with Godzilla as a kid. I think the original Japanese version of Gojira is one of the best movies ever made.
It really is.
It's much more topical than Godzilla King of the Monsters. But my dream Godzilla project would be to do a comic book adaptation of Gojira and Godzilla King of the Monsters put together, going into some of the things they always only hinted at, like what Dr. Serizawa did during the war.
Yeah.
Because obviously he was not up to good stuff during the war.
Right.
Knowing that Raymond Burr was gay, I thought maybe there was a spark between him and the Japanese soldier that was his guide in King of the Monsters. I wanna do the ultimate adaptation of both of those movies together with new material added.
Versus Alien Iceberg.
No.
Okay.
No, that's Mega Shark.
That's Mega Shark. Got it. That too many mashups show.
And actually, let's see. One of my asylum pitches, the one that could be filmed most cheaply, a local filmmaker is trying to get funding for it. It's a horror movie with strong female leads and a supernatural serial killer of a type that I've never seen before, and I've watched an awful lot of these movies.
Yeah.
And we're right now, we're trying to get a grant. If we get this $1 million grant, we could hire SAG actors.
Yeah.
If we raise more than that, I can start calling up people from the Black Lightning cast and other people I know in the entertainment world and get some really good actors together.
Yeah.
You're still a very busy guy.
Yeah, I don't know how. I've got a book publisher that I owe about 12 books to. I'm creating a new superhero universe. I have no idea how to bring it to the marketplace, but it's a superhero universe that nobody's ever thought of. And so far, the lead characters, nobody's ever done anything like them. that's my mantra,
yeah.
Which I stole from Luke Cage. Always forward.
Yes.
Always forward.
Yeah.
While people at DC, and I object to this strongly, want Black Lightning to be Batman's sidekick and Batman and the Outsiders, I go, no. That was great 30 years ago.
Yeah.
He's a headliner. He's not gonna go how high when Batman says jump.
Yeah.
In my new series, he makes it clear that while he respects Batman, he doesn't particularly like or trust him.
Yeah. Even 30 years ago, he wouldn't ask how high.
Yeah. Jefferson Pierce's main concerns are his family, mm-hmm. his students, his community, and his city.
Mm-hmm.
He's not saying that he wouldn't pitch out to help the Justice League.
Yeah.
Or things like that. But he's not going to leave all that behind to be one of Batman's sidekicks.
Right. What would that accomplish?
Right? Yeah, you're going backwards at that point.
And I think we're not going to do much better than that.
I think we got a show.
Thanks, Tony, so much.
Happy to do it.
Yeah, we're happy to have you. I think you might be the most famous person we've interviewed.
Yeah, bar none.
I got to check with Andy Martello.
Yeah, we got to see how many YouTube hits he's got.
Well, on the Price is Right Roadshow, he's the guy that does the announcing.
Okay,
part.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we got to see YouTube. Oh,
you guys
YouTube.
Have to get out more.
Yeah, maybe.
There's lots more famous people than famous people than me at this convention.
How many
of them will let us sit with him for a half hour?
John Schneider wouldn't talk to us. He's Bo Duke. Is that yeah.
If I meet him. First off, we would never talk about politics because he's an arch conservative.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm on the right side of history. But I would probably ask him about two movies that nobody else would. Super Shark and Snow Beast.
Was he in those?
Yes. He was an evil industrialist in Super Shark. So
really, he played himself.
And then in Snow Beast, he was... the guy who ultimately destroys the Snow Beast.
I think I saw Super Shark. That sounds vaguely familiar.
Where should people go if they want to keep up with all the stuff you're doing?
Okay. They can go online. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm at the First Church of Godzilla page.
Nice.
On Facebook. And the best way is to follow me at Tony Isabella's bloggy thing.
Yeah.
It's a night, except for when I'm out at conventions or on the West Coast. It's a Nye Daily blog in which I write about comics, movies, politics, whatever I feel like writing about.
So if somebody wants to argue with you on politics, that's the place to go.
Well, they could try, but since I approve all the comments, if they're idiots, I just don't approve the comments.
Well, there goes half our listeners.
Speaking of the bloggy thing, years ago when you reviewed the very first book I ever drew, and I was working with this little company called Pickle Press at the time.
Yes.
Nick and I are really good friends now, but back then I was working for him. And he's like, "Yeah, I'm gonna get a copy to Tony." I'm like, that to me is like the worlds are colliding, right? Because I'm like, he's one of the reasons why I do this. You know, I read his
you
stuff when I was
set
little.
Your personal bar really low.
Well, you know, we can't help who our heroes are, but He tells me, I sent him to him. He said he's going to put him on his blog, on his review page, and I'm happy, and I'm waiting. And it comes out. And Nick's like, you're going to want to brace yourself. Because you'd written that the story was okay, but like something like the art was nothing to write home about. I was crushed for about 30 seconds. And then I was like, all right, well, I'm going to give him number two. So leaps and bounds because of the review that you gave me for the first book that I did. There's just milestone leap, and it just inspired me to do better.
I've generally done pretty good when it comes to new talent, but I will tell you, I told Terry Austin that he had no future in comics.
Oops.
You can't nail them all.
You know, we talk about the creative process on the show a lot.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things we've talked about is you don't do a person any favors if you tell them their stuff is good.
Right.
Or even if you go, oh, yeah, it looks like you put a lot of work into that. You know, so you're not lying. But if you care enough about a person and you care enough about helping them, you'll be honest. You'll say, well, this kind of sucks. Do better.
Well, when artists bring me their work, and I said, don't show me pinups.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, show me continuity pages.
Yeah.
And I don't talk to the, you know, I might mention something about the actual drawing if it's something that I notice that's really off. Mostly what I talk to them about is the storytelling. And some of it's just basic.
Yeah.
All your characters shouldn't look like they're related.
Unless they are.
Well, yeah, if they are. But, you know, I try to give them basic storytelling help. Because that's where I'm good.
Yeah, you're coming at it from the writer's angle.
Right.
Yeah.
So unless Paul has another thing, I'm going to try to wrap this
up
again.
I just had to get that out. I just wanted him to know.
So go to all those places to follow Tony. And you know to go to DontPanicRadioShow.com to follow our stuff. And we'll have show notes in case you missed all the places to go follow Tony.
Yes.
Paul's going to meticulously listen to this and write it all down. That having been said, for Tony Isabella and for Paul Schultz, I'm Steve Vinson, and nothing you just heard was true.
That's what we keep inside. That's what we keep inside. Mouse, you think you know people and then you don't. Then you wonder, have I met them before? But it doesn't matter. You're just information. That's what we keep inside our heads.
Excuse me. This is a private service.
No, man, I'm Black Lightning.